Israel says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. France, Italy, and several other European countries intensify their lockdowns and restrictions to fight a surge in coronavirus cases. Also in the headlines, an attack on a UN Mali base is under scrutiny. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran says it is opposed to a step-by-step revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Tehran has repeatedly made its stance clear. He said the country's definitive policy is to have all U.S. sanctions lifted. Khatibzadeh said that only after an effective and verified removal of U.S. sanctions, Tehran would reverse its commitment cut under the deal. The remarks came in response to recent comments by the deputy spokeswoman of the U.S. State Department. Jelena Porter said that Washington was willing to negotiate the steps that Iran needed to take to return to compliance under the JCPOA. Earlier political commentator Tohid Asadi joined us with his take on Tehran's opposition to a step-by-step approach toward the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
There is an idea that Biden administration is going through the same trajectory that Trump administration did, and it's trying to kind of persuade Iran for going for further negotiations with no tangible outcome for Tehran. And with that said, I don't think at the time being, under the current circumstances, Iran is going to be that much for this proposal. When it comes to Tehran, currently speaking, any kind of proposal related to JCPOA coming from the United States is just for the sake of wasting the time and nothing in practice in return. So in this context, I think Iran has got this sense that the United States, either under Trump administration or Biden administration, is not a country to be trusted in any kind of negotiation.
The Iranian president has called on people to strictly abide by health protocols to tackle a new spike in coronavirus infections. Hassan Rouhani said a fourth wave of the disease has struck some provinces, and it may grip several other areas if health protocols are not observed. He said shopping sprees in the run-up to the Persian New Year, as well as trips during the holidays, are mainly to blame for the possible nationwide surge in the disease. Meanwhile, President Rouhani said that he was grateful to people as most of them stayed home on the last day of New Year holidays, when Iranians normally go on picnics and spend the day outdoors. Bahrainis have staged rallies to demand an immediate and unconditional release of all political prisoners amid the coronavirus pandemic. The demonstrations took place in the capital Manama and 18 other towns and villages across the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Protesters carried signs reading that political prisoners are facing the threat of COVID-19 and overcrowded cells. Rights activists have also sounded the alarm that the respiratory disease is spreading among prisoners. According to London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, dozens of COVID cases have been recorded among inmates. Bahrain's Public Prosecution Office has announced that 126 prisoners will be freed to serve their terms outside of jails under electronic monitoring because of the pandemic. The country has registered some 150,000 infections and over 500 deaths. Well, it's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli settlers have forced their way into Jerusalem's Flashpoint Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to celebrate a Jewish holiday. Palestinians have condemned the move, calling it provocative. Mona Kandil has more.
Israeli settlers have escalated their daily raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds in the last couple of days during their celebrations of one of the Jewish holidays known as Passover. On Thursday alone, hundreds of Israeli settlers raided the holy site under the protection of Israeli forces, according to the Muslim religious authorities, or what's known as the Awqaf, which administrates the compound. Palestinian officials denounced what they described as provocative moves, saying that Israel has simultaneously banned Palestinian worshippers from entering the mosque.
The Israelis are accompanied and protected by soldiers and are allowed to raid the site and desecrate it. The Israeli forces closed the markets and the shops in the old town. A number of Palestinian youths were detained. It was another occupation of the Al-Aqsa complex and the old town, but this time by the settlers along with the soldiers.
Israeli settler groups have called on their supporters to converge on the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in celebration of Passover, which began on March 27 and lasts until April 3. Thousands of Israeli soldiers were deployed across Jerusalem Al-Quds to provide a protection to settlers who toured in groups the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and took photos of several places. Other strict measures have also been taken on Friday to prevent Muslims reach the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Experts believe the incursions are part of Israel's policy to Judaize the holy site and expel the Palestinians out from the holy city.
The Israeli regime is escalating the situation in Jerusalem Al-Quds. It's only mounting tensions. The Israeli prime minister is facing internal problems and he's looking for ways to survive. He knows settlers will help him to do so. That is why he won't stop their acts. Therefore, the settlers are provided with a good opportunity to desecrate the site and provoke the Palestinians during their holidays.
Since its occupation of the Palestinian lands, Israel has been launching violence to crack down on Palestinians in different ways, especially when it serves Tel Aviv's interests. During the Jewish holidays, Israeli settlers escalate their raids into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Palestinians say the raids are provocative and pursue the policy of suppression by Israeli regime against the Palestinian people living in the holy city of Al-Quds. Mona Qadif, Occupy Ramallah.
Jafar Romini is a Palestinian writer and political analyst who joins us from Perth. We also have Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. Mick Napier, let me first start with you. Tell us the reason why Palestinians are so outraged when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and how they are banned by Israel by going and praying in that mosque time and again.
Well, as your correspondent said, she used the word daily attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It may not be daily, but it's pretty close. The pressure is constant, and I think it comes from two sources. One is the extremist groups in the Israeli political spectrum who make no secret of the fact that they wish to take over and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and replace it with a so-called third temple, and they are quite prepared to pursue that agenda. It's interesting, by the way, that the Temple Mount Institute receives funding from the Israeli government to pursue this agenda, as well as from Jewish billionaires in the USA. So this is a constant pressure from that element of the Israeli political spectrum. But Netanyahu also has to worry about them, because they have allies within his government and his immediate competition. The recent elections marked a decisive shift to the Zionist right, i.e. to the elements who openly call for the expulsion of all Palestinians, every last one, and their replacement with Jewish settlers. So Netanyahu's looking over his shoulders at these people. He doesn't want to be outflanked by people who claim, as Gantz did in a previous election, that he could kill more Palestinians than Netanyahu did, or that they can be harder on Palestinians in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So it's also part of the wider picture. The Zionists make no secret of it. They wish to take over 100% of Palestine with no Palestinians, and that does not exempt the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Your viewers need to think about this. It's not an open secret. It's an open program. We saw a few years ago, I think it was 2017, Israel put up so-called metal detectors around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to control the ingress and egress of every Palestinian. The result was a mass civil disobedience, mass prayer outside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians refused to pray inside there under Israeli control. And Netanyahu was forced to retreat, because I guess you know, the point I would make is, however determined they are to remove all Palestinians and some of them to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque, they remain actually afraid of 400 million Arabs and other Middle Eastern peoples who revere the Al-Aqsa Mosque and for whom its destruction would be a red line, a massive red line. So it's a constant situation, but at the moment Netanyahu may be inclined to give a wink and a nod to these people because of the recent shift to the register during the elections.
Yeah, Jafar Ramini, when you take a look at some of the testimonies from Palestinians, you know, they're very outraged. And at the same time, they're very saddened because they can't pray at the mosque. One particular testimony that I'm reading here says that in a period of, let me make sure I have the figure right, in a period of, 120 days, was it? I don't have that. Okay, in a matter of 6 months, only a number of 4 or 5 times this particular person was able to pray there. And yet it says in this particular testimony you have settlers that go in there once in a while, you have Israeli journalists that actually go in there, you have tourists that actually can go in inside the mosque, but Palestinians can't. What is the reason for this restriction that the Israeli regime places on Palestinians when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
There is nothing for me to add to what your other guest has said other than to change one word. It's a constant plan. It's not a program. It's a plan. It's the original plan of the Zionists to overtake Palestine, to steal our land and natural resources, and kick us out. When I was 5 years old in 1948, the message was, leave or die. The message now is kill them all. And Al-Aqsa Mosque is in their sight, and they have been doing this for years and years, especially in the last 4 years since Trump assumed power in Washington. And every single year during this time, Passover, there's a total shutdown of the entire landmass of Palestine for 10 days. The Palestinians cannot go anywhere or do anything during Passover. Al-Aqsa Mosque is one aspect of this. And shame on all the Muslim countries, especially those who hurried to normalize with Israel, that they have abandoned Al-Aqsa Mosque. But we, the Palestinians, are willing and able to defend it to the last man standing. There is another aspect to Jerusalem, which is the ethnic cleansing, total ethnic cleansing of Jerusalem, and kicking out all Palestinians by all means available to Israel, the army, the government, and the settlers. There is an ongoing situation now in part of East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, where the Israeli government and the High Court has issued an eviction order for over 1,000 Palestinian families. Why? Because they want to turn that place into a park. So the people are not important. The Palestinians who lived there for thousands of years are not important. A park for the Israeli settlers to walk about and have fun is more important than our homes and our lives. Again, shame on the Arabs, shame on the Muslims, and shame on the international community for allowing this atrocity to continue for over 100 years. And I want you to stop here over the number. Over 100 years, the Zionists and their allies and their collaborators in the area have been trying to get rid of us. Listen to me, Netanyahu, and your cheerleaders in the West, we are not going anywhere. This is our land. We are Canaanites. We've been there 10,000 years, and we are not leaving anywhere. We are not going. We will defend it to the last man standing.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, Jafar Ramini, Palestinian writer and political analyst from Perth, and thank you, Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign from Edinburgh. And that brings us to the end of this news review. Thanks for tuning in. Several European nations have tightened coronavirus restrictions amid worrying spikes in infections ahead of Easter. Italy has begun a strict lockdown, declaring the entire country a high-risk coronavirus red zone. New curbs have also come into force in France, where a dramatic rise in cases has overwhelmed hospitals in the capital, Paris. Other countries like Belgium and Germany have also intensified bans for Easter. It's a time when families usually hold reunions. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has urged people to limit their social contacts ahead of the break. COVID-19 pandemic has claimed more than 2.8 million lives worldwide with no end in sight. France is the hardest-hit country in Europe, with over 4.6 million cases and more than 95,000 deaths. Correspondents in Paris and Rome joined us earlier with the latest on the coronavirus situation in the two European countries.
Well, it's the third nationwide lockdown, and the schools are closed. There is also the Easter holidays, and other measures are taken, like the limitation of 10 kilometers of movement. The figures are very, very tough. The health situation is getting almost out of control, with more than 40,000 daily new contaminations, especially due to the English variant. More than 300 deaths daily on an average base, and the hospitals are overloaded with more than 5,000 persons in emergency units. The only positive point maybe is that the vaccination campaign is accelerating.
The situation is not under control in Italy. According to the health ministry data, yesterday we had 529 new COVID-19 related deaths. And that this is bringing the national death toll to about 109,000 since the start of the pandemic in February 2020. Italy is right now under red zone restrictions, and this is going to be the case for the entire of the Easter holidays to prevent social interaction fueling contagion. The Interior Ministry has put in place measures, including an extra 70,000 police officers that will be put in the field over Easter in a move to intensify controls and checks.
Four United Nations peacekeepers have been killed in an attack on a camp in northern Mali. The UN mission said 19 others were also wounded in the attack carried out by several heavily armed terrorists on Friday. It said the attackers also suffered heavy losses. Also on Friday, three Malian soldiers were killed in another attack blamed on terrorists. Mali has been mired in violence since 2012, with Al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups fighting for the control of central and the northern regions. The violence has remained uncontained despite military assistance from the UN. Thousands have died in the attacks, including about 230 UN peacekeepers. Rescue operations continue at the site of a deadly train crash in eastern Taiwan. Workers have begun removing parts of the train in Hualien City. The last wagon was relatively undamaged, having come to a stop outside of the tunnel where the accident happened. It was pulled down from the crash site. The more heavily damaged sections of the train are still mangled inside the tunnel. The crash occurred after the train carrying almost 500 people collided with a truck belonging to a construction site manager. Taiwanese prosecutors are seeking an arrest warrant for him. At least 51 people died in the accident. The crash was Taiwan's worst train accident in seven decades. Security forces in Myanmar have killed five more people as anti-coup protesters once again hit the streets of several towns. Local media say that three people were shot dead in the central town of Manyua on Saturday after security forces opened fire to disperse the protesters. One man was also killed in Bago and another in Thataun. Myanmar has been in turmoil since February after the military ousted the civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi over allegations of voter fraud in the November elections. People have been holding rallies on an almost daily basis to demand a return to civilian rule. The military junta, however, has intensified the crackdown despite international outcry. A monitoring group says that more than 550 people have been killed in the protest. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
One-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. They used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head sharanks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes. Everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed. How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the sprain. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Ken Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles, or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yeah.
If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You put my shirt down now.
Mm. Yeah. No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a band-aid on it. And I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
I horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. You know, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, and thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of The Lantern. Contrary to popular belief, especially after certain events that took place by the hands of some extremists during the few last decades, unfortunately, there's this common misconception that Islam is in some form a religion that promotes violence against those who don't see eye to eye with it, that Islam is an intolerant religion that allows the killing and bloodshed of anyone who stands in its way, anyone who doesn't embrace it as the final and most complete religion, and that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or the Holy Quran gives us the green light to draw our sword against anyone who doesn't seem to want to listen to our words of preaching, quote unquote, and accept it as their way of salvation. So today I thought it would be a good idea if we talked about this whole concept of violence versus nonviolence. And how is it in any way, or whether it is it in any way, a resort, a solution for people who claim to be practicing the religion of Islam? Let's listen to a short little story regarding this matter, and we're going to be right back. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salamun alaikum and welcome to this program entitled Lantern. A story about Gandhi. Author Stephen R. Covey. I once heard Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, share this penetrating insight about his grandfather. All in attendance at his speech were both humbled and electrified. Ironically, if it hadn't been for a racism and prejudice, we may not have had a Gandhi. He may have been just another successful lawyer who had made a lot of money. But because of prejudice in South Africa, he was subjected to humiliation within a week of his arrival. He was thrown off a train because of the color of his skin, and it humiliated him so much that he sat on a platform of the station all night wondering what he could do to gain justice. His first response was one of the anger. He was so angry that he wanted eye for eye justice. He wanted to respond violently to the people who humiliated him. But he stopped himself and said, "That's not right." It was not going to get him justice. It might have made him feel good for a moment, but it wasn't going to get him any justice. The second response was to want to go back to India and live among his own people in dignity. He ruled that out also. He said, "You can't run away from problems. You've got to stay and face the problems." And that's when the third response dawned on him. The response of nonviolent action. From that point onwards, he developed the philosophy of nonviolence and practiced it in his life as well as in his search for justice in South Africa. He ended up staying in that country for 22 years, and then he went and led the movement of India.
Thank you.
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So Mahatma Gandhi is known as one of the most exceptional contemporary freedom fighters. He is a very prominent character in modern history. I don't think there is a single soul on the face of earth who doesn't know him, or at least, you know, that there was such a movement in India, and there was this wise sage, peaceful little man who was involved with it in some way and changed the course of history, not just for the people of India, but as a role model for peace and non-violence. Ironically enough, however, I have come across a quote attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, and it basically relates the story of how he drew inspiration from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and in the battle against right and wrong, justice and injustice, good and evil, and how he was inspired by Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to fight against the sword, to fight against injustice, tyranny, violence, with blood, by not that he used oppression as a tool, rather, even though he was oppressed, seemingly, he was the one who came out victorious and triumphant, because fast forward 300 something years later, it is Imam Hussein alayhi salam's name, which is revered and honored, and it is he who is loved and adored by millions and millions of people across the world. This whole theme of nonviolence isn't really something that is specific to Mahatma Gandhi because of the inspiration he got from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's movement isn't unprecedented in the creed of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and also it's not one of a kind in the sense that had it been any other imam in that situation, they would have done the same thing. Had Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam been in any other era, and had he been fighting any other tyrant, even one that wasn't as bloodthirsty and cruel as Yazid alayhi lana, he would have still done the same thing. As a matter of fact, even if Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam was in that situation where a great war was waged against him, and the life of himself and his companions and his family members were threatened, he would have still done the same thing. But I want us to go back and look in the life and time of the Ahlul Bayt and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, their reaction toward violence, all those times, all the chances they were allowed to kill someone who hurt them, who violated their rights, who committed some sort of injustice toward them. All the times that the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam had the chance to retaliate and reciprocate in violence, what did they do really? Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.